the vacuum, okay? Or whatever it might mean, the vacuum. Remember some technical things from last time? We can use different choices of mode functions to express the quantum field. We can choose mode functions that we may call vk, or we can choose mode functions v tilde k, and there are infinitely many choices. Whichever one we choose, we will get the same quantum field. Any choice of set of mode functions vk comes with its associated a and a dagger operators. For the mode functions without a tilde, we will use a and a dagger operators without tildes, and for those with a tilde or any other signature, we put the corresponding signature also on the a and a dagger. Now, we did a Fourier transform. You notice that here the quantum field depends no longer on position, but on the momenta, and so do the mode functions. This simplified things tremendously. We used to have a Klein-Gordon equation. It was a partial differential equation. Now we have a Klein-Gordon equation that is an ordinary differential equation. It has only one kind of derivative in it. That's the time derivatives. And the space of solutions for each fixed k is now only two-dimensional, two complex dimensional, four real dimensional. So overall, yes, there are infinitely many choices of those mode functions, but that's just because in a two-dimensional complex vector space, you can still choose an infinite number of directions. But it's just a two-dimensional complex vector space, out of which you can choose the v and the v tildes and so on. This means that if you start out with one choice of mode function and you want to consider another choice of mode function, then let's call that another choice, the choice of the v tilde k, the vk tilde mode functions, then we know right away that those tilded mode functions are a linear combination of the untilded one. Remember, this is because v and its complex conjugate, v star, form a basis in the two-dimensional space of complex solutions. Therefore, any other mode function, any other solution to the Klein-Gordon equation is a linear combination of the two we started with. Down here is a comment, just to remind you that not every solution of the Klein-Gordon equation is eligible to be used as a mode function. Instead, the solution to the Klein-Gordon equation also has to obey the so-called Wronskian condition, which ensured that the commutation relations between the A and A dagger properly translated into the commutation relations between chi and its momentum field. I left it to you as an exercise to show that when you put together those two equations, the equation that expresses the field either in the untilded or in the tilded variables, and this relationship between the mode functions, if you put that together, in other words, you put the v tildes in here, you put this expression for the v tildes in here, then you have only untilded v's, but you have the a and a dagger, and you have the a tildes and the a tilde dagger, then you can derive the relationship from that equation between the a and the a tilde operator. And here it is in the box. It turns out that the a operators, some coefficient times the a tilde operator plus some coefficient times the a tilde dagger operator, where the coefficients are just those, the linear combination coefficients of the new mode functions in terms of the old mode functions. These very same coefficients allow us to describe the A operators in terms of the A dagger operators. And that equation is also invertible. Because really, it's two equations, this one and the Hermitian conjugate of it. Right? You could put a dagger in here, and then you get no longer an alpha star, but just alpha. Here you would get a beta star. That becomes an A tilde dagger, and the dagger goes away. So you have two equations, and you can solve those two equations for the two unknowns, a tilde and a tilde dagger. So you get a very similar equation that expresses the tilded raising and lowering operators in terms of the untilded ones. It will be an exercise to a little lower. Okay. It will be an exercise to actually calculate that inverse. Then we said, okay, this is very valuable because we are pursuing all of the transformation from one way of writing the quantum field into the other way of writing the quantum field using one set of mode functions or the other set of mode functions. And so we want to also get the map from the one Fock basis to the other Fock basis. And this is the key to getting that map. Namely, consider the state 0 that is annihilated by A. We can write A in this way, and we obtain then this equation here. Now that's an equation that allows us to calculate what this vector 0 is in terms of the tilded operators. Here, this was the answer, or the solution. The untilded 0 can be expressed as a linear combination of the tilded Fock basis vectors in this way. This is a, just if you spell it all out, this is a linear combination. Namely, you have here a series for the exponential. You get powers of the A tilde operator, the A dagger tilde operators acting on the 0 tilde vector. And so overall, you get an expansion of the untilded vacuum in the Fock basis of the tilded variables. And we can not only express this vector in terms of that Hilbert basis, but also all of its excitations. If you apply an A dagger operator here, then you can do the same thing on the right-hand side by taking the A dagger operator representation that you get here. Just take the Hermitian conjugate of that equation, then you have A dagger equal to whatever you get on the right-hand side. So you apply that on here, and again, you end up expressing a vector that is easy to write down in the untilded basis in terms of a linear combination in the tilded basis. Okay, so we get the entire unitary map from one Hilbert basis to the other. Here's an example scenario where we're going to use this. Let's assume we choose mode functions v and v tilde such that the associated vectors 0 and 0 tilde happen to be the vacuum states of the quantum field at times eta 1 and eta 2, respectively. In fact, maybe I should say that already here. The goal of this lecture today will be to find out which vector in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum. Can be a different vector at different times. And we don't have a criterion yet for checking through the Hilbert space and finding out, well, is this vector the one that describes the vacuum, or is that vector the vector that describes the vacuum? But we will develop criteria for that today. For now, let's just assume that we have some criterion, and therefore that we can tell which is the vacuum state at a particular point in time. So the assumption here is that at time eta 1, this vector happens to be the physical vacuum. And at time eta 2, that vector in the Hilbert space happens to be describing the physical vacuum. Then let's assume that the system at time eta 1, which is an earlier time, is in that state, zero here, which by assumption is the vacuum at that time. So let's assume that our quantum field starts out at time eta 1 in the vacuum. And by vacuum, I mean no particle state. Then at a later time eta 2, for example, the system will still be in the state omega that it started out in because we work here in the Heisenberg picture. But if the vacuum state at a later time is this state, no longer that one, but if the vacuum state is this state in the Hilbert space, then it means we have particle creation because the system is still in that state by the Heisenberg picture, right? It's always in the same state, omega, which is the same as that one. So if at a later time this state is no longer the vacuum state, it's got to be an excited state, so we have particle production. And this transformation from one Hilbert basis to the other tells us how many particles have been produced. Well, how many particles will be produced? Let's look back at equation T, this transformation here. It expresses the vacuum at an early time as a linear combination of excited states over the vacuum at a later time. And what we see is that there is a finite probability amplitude for finding arbitrarily many particles at the later time. Why is that? Well, this is an exponential, and we have here, when we write it down as a series, arbitrarily high powers of this arising. Arbitrarily high powers of creation operators acting on the zero tilde vacuum of the later time. That means that the vacuum state of time eta 1, which happens to be the state in which the quantum field is in, and will always be because of the Heisenberg picture, that state is a linear combination of excited states over the tilde vacuum of the later time with arbitrarily high excitations, just because there's always a finite prefactor when we look at the term in that series that has a very high power of those. Now, that could mean that we have an infinite number of particles being created. After all, the probability for any finite number of particles is finite. We'll have to look into this. In principle, it could go very extreme. It could be very bad. It could be that we're predicting here so much particle creation that the energy expense of that halts the expansion of the universe. It would be at the expense of the expansion. Ultimately, particles will contribute to the energy momentum tensor, and that couples into the curvature through the Einstein equation. So let us calculate the expected number of created particles, the expected number of particles created through the expansion. For this purpose, we will use the number operator that I assume you remember from quantum mechanics. It's just the operator A dagger A. And it's called the number operator because when you apply it to the nth excited state, then after you work out the computation of the number operator, you find that you get back the same state up to prefactor n, which is to say that the nth eigenstate is an eigenvector to the number operator with that number, that eigenvalue. So we define in quantum field theory a number operator to be, we define a number operator for each individual mode. For each k, we have another number operator, and the number of particles in total will simply be the sum over all number operators for all k. So let's assume in quantum field theory, let's assume that at some time eta, the state zero happens to be the physical vacuum state. So it's this vector in the Hilbert space that describes the vacuum state. Then this vector will describe a state with n particles of momentum k present. Now let's say that at this time, the system is in an arbitrary, the quantum field theoretical system is in some arbitrary state omega. Then what is the expected number of particles of momentum k? Well, we just have to calculate the expectation value in this state of the number operator for the particles of momentum k. Let's calculate that. In the above scenario, so we have that the quantum field at an early time, eta 1, was prepared in the vacuum state. Then some evolution happened. The vacuum state is a different state now at a later time, eta 2. At eta 2, we want to know how many particles have been created. So we want to know what is the expectation value of the number operator n tilde for particles of momentum k. Okay, so the k means number operator, number of particles of momentum k, n tilde because we are looking at the later time, eta 2, and the bar on top of the tilde means expectation value. So we're calculating the expectation value of that number operator. This is the state of the quantum field. Remember, Heisenberg picture, always the same state. Therefore, we can also write it as this. It's the state with a zero here, right? Because the quantum field, by assumption, started out at time eta 1 in that state which at time eta 1 was the vacuum state. So we are calculating this expectation value here for that state. The number operator at time eta 2, though, is expressed in terms of the tilded versions of the A and the A daggers. So we have here a vector 0 that comes from the construction without the tilde, and those guys have a tilde in them. Not a problem, though, because we can express, if we want to, either this state in terms of the tilded linear combination of the tilded Fock states, or we can express those tilded A and A dagger operators in terms of the untilded ones, and then it becomes easy to work all of this out. We'll pursue that latter, the latter strategy. Remember, we found that the A operator can be expressed in terms of the tilded operators in this way. And I already mentioned that there is an inverse map. Here it is. I leave it to you to prove or to show what the values are of those coefficients. Clearly, the tilded operators have to be, one moment, tilded operators have to be some coefficients times the untilded operators. And let's call those coefficients alpha tilde and beta tilde. The alpha tilde and beta tilde will depend on the untilded alpha and beta, and it's not so hard to calculate what they are. Leave it up to you. Yes?
I'm a bit confused. Before you said that the state at time eta 1 was an arbitrary state omega, but you didn't say it was a vacuum, right?
When we discussed the definition of the number operator, we didn't assume that it was the vacuum. But then we went back to the scenario earlier, where we said it would be the vacuum. Okay, so at time eta 1, the system starts out in the vacuum state. And that state, that Hilbert space state, will always describe our quantum system. It's just that later on, that very same Hilbert space state has no longer the interpretation of being the vacuum state. Okay, so the system started out in the state omega. We'd always be in that state, and it's the state 0. The number operator at a later time has to be expressed in terms of the tilded operators, Because the vacuum state is a different one. It's the one that comes with the V tilde wave functions and the tilded A and A daggers. So the number operator has to be built from those guys. Now, we inverted that equation here to obtain this equation, which allows us to express the tilded A and A dagger operators in terms of the untilded ones. We plug that straight into here. And we obtain that this expectation value of the number of particles with momentum k is given now by this expression here. All I've done is plug this into there. We get this. And right away, we see that a lot of terms will drop out. For example, here we have an annihilation. No, this one. This is an annihilation operator acting on that. Both untilded. This one is annihilating this one. And similarly, the dagger will annihilate this one. In total, we have four terms, clearly, because there are two times two, four terms. Three of them go away in this way. And there's one left over. It's a beta star beta term. And here we have a dagger. Okay, we can use the commutation relations to write this in terms of... So here we have a and a dagger. The a dagger doesn't annihilate that, and the A doesn't annihilate this. So how do we calculate the expectation value? We use the canonical commutation relations between A and A dagger to write A dagger as A dagger A plus 1. And when we do that, we find that we have an annihilation operator acting to the right that will kill this term, and which is left with a 1 here. Overall, therefore, this is the number of the expected number of particles of momentum k. Remember that. That's a very important result. What we found is that the expected number of particles created with momentum k is given by this beta squared, or beta tilde squared, where the beta is this coefficient here. So we express here the alpha tilde as a linear combination of A and A dagger. The coefficient in front of A is alpha, and the one in front of A dagger is beta. If the beta coefficient were vanishing, in other words, if the only thing that happened is that the A gets rescaled, then there would be no particle creation. So only if A becomes a proper linear combination of both A and A dagger, then we have particle creation. In fact, that one could vanish. As long as beta is non-zero, we will have particle creation. So it'll be the beta coefficients that we have to look out for. And the beta coefficients will eventually determine the statistics of the cosmic microwave background as well. Not through particle creation, though, but these are the coefficients that will matter. So what's the total particle number then? Well, the expected total number of particles produced between the time eta 1 and the time eta 2 out of the vacuum is then the sum of the expected number of particles for each of the momenta. Let's say we put the whole thing in a box so that we don't have to integrate. We only have to sum over a discrete set of modes. Then the expected total number of particles produced is given by that sum over all of the beta coefficients squared. That is a series now. There are infinitely many of those terms. Or alternatively, if we don't put it in a box, it's an integral. And that integral can diverge. That sum can be divergent, even though the probability or the expectation value for the number of particles for any given momentum may be finite. The sum of them may easily be infinite. Something happened. Oop. I don't know how that happened. Just a sec. Sorry, I touched the wrong place on the screen and then it jumped very far. Okay, there we go. Okay. Writing it in terms of a sum meant that we have an infrared cutoff, so we assume that the system is somehow put into a big box. Now, in principle, it could happen that the expected number of particles comes out infinite when we integrate this up. It could come out infinite, but that can be okay. We can have, for example, an infinite number of photons. As long as the energy that's in them is not infinite, or the energy density that's in them is not infinite, it's still fine. In fact, that's the generic situation. If you calculate the number of photons being created when you wave around a charge, technically it comes out infinite. I mean, that's a different mechanism, of course. In electromagnetism, we don't have curvature. But with curvature, same thing as with exciting particles through accelerating a charge. When you excite quantum fields to create particles due to expansion, you can also have an infinite number of particles around. You can avoid this by putting a penalty on that. Namely, if either the particles have a mass or you put the system in a box, then that will not happen. Because then each particle will cost at least a certain minimum amount of energy. Right? If you have particles that have a mass, then at the very least, the particles must have the energy that it takes to create that mass, E equal mc squared. Therefore, if you had infinitely many particles, you'd have infinitely much energy. And similarly, when you put your particles in a box, then the lowest excitation, the lowest momentum that's possible there, lowest excitation there, will have a certain finite amount of energy. And so, again, if you had infinitely many particles, you would have an infinite amount of energy. Now we get to the main question. How do we identify which vector in the Hilbert space describes what we physically think of as the vacuum state? And by that, we mean the no particle state. First of all, it's not clear that such a thing exists in nature. Strictly speaking, I'm pretty sure there isn't. We get to that a little later. It's basically because if one part of the universe, for example, were expanding, and another part were contracting at the same time, you would, roughly speaking, have one criterion to obey to describe a mode function, choose a mode function that will describe the growing part to be in the vacuum state. And then there's another criterion to obey to make sure that also the shrinking part is in the vacuum state. And they are generally not compatible. So there's probably no way that a generic universe that maybe not contracts here and expands there at the same time, but expands at different rates in different places, which is very much realistic, just doesn't, it's just not possible that it has no particles. Even in principle. But in the case of a Friedmann-Robertson-Walker spacetime, where the universe expands in all directions exactly the same rate, we are close enough to Minkowski space that we can write down an exact vacuum state. How can we identify it? It would be very useful to have that, because once we have a vacuum state, we can easily count the number of particles. In a generic situation, it's always going to be imprecise. So in a cosmological situation, expanding spacetime, how do we identify which vector in the Hilbert space describes the physical no particle state, the physical vacuum? We could call it vacuum at eta, because we have to recognize that it may be a different vector at different times. First thing to ask is the actual physical vacuum state at the time eta one of the states zero without a tilde, with a tilde, with two tildes, or whatever, infinitely many choices. Is it actually one of those states? Is it one of those states that can be singled out by choosing a mode function such as v, v tilde, v double tilde, and so on? Where those guys are defined as the vectors that are annihilated by the A operators corresponding to the respective mode functions. As we will see, yes, that can be done if the vacuum state at the particular time exists at all. And for FRW spacetimes it will, then there exist suitable mode functions, Vk, such that the quantum field can be expressed in this way, and such that the mode function is associated with A and a dagger operator, such that the vector that's annihilated by the corresponding A is that physical state. So I'm just saying in many words that, yes, it can be done. But how? There seems to be so much choice. There's a two-dimensional vector space of solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation for every k. For every mode k, we have to make another decision, which is the right mode function to use. So which v should we choose? Which mode function v should we choose? So that that vector 0 that comes along with it coincides with the vacuum at a particular choice of time eta. And of course, if you want to know, if you want to describe the vacuum at a later time, for example, then we have to go back and find another mode function such that its associated 0 tilde vector happens to be the vacuum at a later time. So at some specific time, how do we identify which vector in the Hilbert space it is that describes the physical vacuum? Now specifying, now we will aim at specifying the vacuum state by specifying one of those zero vectors. We want to be able to say that at the time eta, the physical vacuum state, the no particle state, is described by the vector 0 with mode with the untilded mode function, where we can write down an explicit mode function that does the trick. That is equivalent, sorry, to write down that vector 0 is equivalent to specifying, you know, without the tilde, is equivalent to specifying the mode function, right? I mean, to specify the a candidate vacuum state is to specify the mode function. They are one-in-one correspondence. Right, because all the untilded quantities hang together. Now, here's the trick. Equivalent to specifying either a mode function or the vacuum that comes with it, or the vector zero that comes with it, equivalent to that is it to specify at some time both the amplitude and the derivative of the mode function in question. This is not a big statement here. All I'm saying is that a vacuum vector is determined by the corresponding mode function, and every mode function is determined by an amplitude and a derivative at a particular time. That's because a mode function is a solution to the Klein-Gödel equation, which is second order in time. If you give an initial condition of an amplitude and a derivative, then you have fixed the mode function everywhere. Okay? So if we tell what the amplitude and the derivative of a mode function is at any time, then we have nailed down exactly what that mode function is for all time, just because of the Klein-Gödel equation. And it will be convenient to choose at that time, to choose that time to be the same time as where we want to identify what the vacuum state is, just for convenience. But in principle, we wouldn't have to, right? We can fix a mode function by telling at an arbitrary point in time, this is its amplitude, that's its derivative. Just two numbers. Just two numbers will identify which mode function, and therefore which vector zero, therefore which vacuum. Right? So if somebody tells you, I know for sure the vacuum, what was the vacuum state at which vector described, which Hilbert space vector described the vacuum at a time eta? And then you ask, well, which one is it? And then that person would say, well, it's that vacuum which you get when you use the mode function that has amplitude such and such and derivative so and so at a particular time. That's enough, because now you can calculate what the mode function is. That will give you the vector zero, gives you the vacuum state. Okay. And in practice, we'll ask that person to give us the amplitude and derivative at the time where we want to identify what the vacuum state is, just for convenience. Okay, so the specification of the vacuum can be done by just giving two numbers at a particular time. We still don't know how we have to choose those numbers, but we know that it suffices to know two numbers to fix the vacuum state. Of course, you need to have two numbers for each mode. For each K, you have to have those two numbers. So here's our first attempt at actually identifying which vector in the Hilbert space describes the physical vacuum, the state without particles. It's the, in some sense, most obvious choice. Let's try to define the vacuum state at a particular time eta as that Hilbert space vector, which at that time minimizes the energy, minimizes the Hamiltonian. It would seem plausible that the state without particles is the state of lowest energy at a given time. So whatever at a given time is the state of lowest energy, we try to identify with the vacuum state at that time. So the aim will be to choose those two numbers R and S for each mode in such a way that the energy at the time eta is minimized. Okay? So if we are trying now to identify which vector in the Hilbert space describes the no particle state at time eta, we are free to choose those parameters R and S. We have to use that freedom to choose that vector zero, which has lowest energy. Okay, so we choose an amplitude for the mode function. We choose a derivative for the mode function at the time eta. That determines the mode function everywhere. And then we plug that into the expression for the energy, for the Hamiltonian. And we find out what the energy is. Then we play around with those R and S to make the energy as small as it can get. So here's this in practice. Oh, I think I'm running out of energy here. That's why the screen goes dark. By the way, if there are any questions, please do ask.
Yeah.
Yep.
So when we talk about the energy of the state, are we taking into account the energy of the particles that exist at the time? Because if you include that, then the whole remains constant.
Well, see, at this stage, we don't know which state has particles and which one doesn't. So what we are doing here is, 9% left, you see. Okay, so remember, the strategy is this. We don't know yet which Hilbert space vector describes no particles. And therefore, we don't know yet which Hilbert space vector describes 5 particles or 20 particles. We have no idea. What we do is we scan through all possible candidates for what might be the vacuum state. By running through all possible values of R and S, we are running through all possible vacuum states, and we check them out. For each one of those possible vacuum states, we calculate the energy expectation value. Remember that this vector zero here depends on what we choose for R and S, for those coefficients R and S. And we will vary those coefficients R and S such that this energy, the energy expectation value, goes minimal. So we are looking for that state in the Hilbert space which minimizes the energy expectation value. And then we will say that is probably the vacuum. And only once we have that can we then say, OK, this is the one particle state, that's the two particle state, and so on.
So my point was, supposing you start with a zero particle state, it has some energy.
Yeah.
Now we say add one particle.
Yeah.
But the energy should remain the same because that particle was created out of the energy of the vacuum state or the zero state.
No. It will have higher energy. You know, as we showed very early in the course, if you remember, whenever you apply a creation operator on one of those here, you're going up in the harmonic oscillator by one level. And, you know, the field is composed of those harmonic oscillators. So you go up by one level in the energy in total, because the total energy of the field is given by the sum of the energies of each of its harmonic oscillators. So the energy does go up when you have extra particles. All right, so here, I'm writing down the Hamiltonian expressed as the Hamiltonian of the chi field in this way. That's the kinetic term of the chi field. Here we have spatial derivatives, that's the Laplacian. And then this here was the time-dependent omega squared term. This is all integrated over space. Let's do a Fourier transform. And we do a... we do a Fourier transform, and we express the quantum field in terms of its mode functions and its A and A dagger operators. And here's the result. We do that in a box. We calculate the energy expectation value in a box, which is not just convenient because momentum integrations become sums over momenta, but also because if we didn't restrict it to a box, we would be calculating the total energy of the universe. That cannot be 5 or 7 joules or whatever. It can only be 0 or infinite. Because we're integrating over all of R3, and the thing is translation invariant. So if there was any energy density, it would add up to a total energy that's infinite. It's much more interesting, therefore, to calculate the energy just in a finite size box. Dividing by the volume gives us the energy density. So it makes sense to minimize the energy contained in a box, but not really to minimize the energy in all of R3, because that starts out being infinite and will always be infinite. OK, so we calculate the energy in a box of large size, given that the system is in a state 0 here, where we really haven't quite decided yet which state that is. Because that will be the state that comes from a mode function V. But we haven't decided yet what mode function V that is. It will be determined by those coefficients R and S that give the amplitude and the derivative at time eta, or time eta 1. OK, so what we're doing is we are putting the, we're writing down the energy density in terms of the field. And the field we express now in terms of the mode functions and the creation and annihilation operators. So this all has become a little bit messy now. But that's just because if you look back at where we started, that's just the regular Hamiltonian, okay? Kinetic term, Laplacian, the back-driving force term. And then we do a Fourier transform where this becomes a k squared times chi squared. The k squared actually will go in here because we will have no longer any derivatives on chi. So it goes along with this term. We put the whole thing in a box. Do the Fourier series expansion. And we express the Fourier transformed field in terms of its mode, in terms of its mode functions. So wherever you had a chi squared up here, for example, or up here or there, you expect now 4 terms, right? Because the chi is expressed in terms of two terms, this and that, we have to square it. So no wonder that we get plenty of terms over here. Here they are. Lots of them don't contribute anything. Because, for example, the A dagger acting to the left on that zero is going to annihilate it. And similarly, this A acting to the right is going to be annihilated. But they're going to be mixed terms that will contribute. And they are here. And then everything put together is just that. So what we find is that the total energy in a box for the state 0 that comes from a mode function V is given by that expression at a time eta 1. Calculated the energy in the box at a time eta 1. And just to remind you, the time-dependent frequency of the harmonic oscillator of the mode K was given by this expression over here. This one, k squared plus m squared a squared plus this thing. Remember, that's the crucial term later, that will be the crucial term later on, because it can flip the sign of that and can induce that we are no longer even dealing with a harmonic oscillator. Because that when that sign flips, then the backdriving force is no longer backdriving. It's pushing away. When omega squared becomes negative, when this term dominates, then the harmonic oscillator potential is no longer a parabola that points upwards, it's one that points downwards. You will get runaway solutions instead of oscillatory solutions. In fact, they will run away exponentially fast, or almost exponentially fast. That doesn't mean that the amplitude of the field actually grows exponentially. Well, the amplitude of the chi field will grow exponentially. But remember that the chi field is not the physical field. The phi field is. It differs from chi by a scale factor A, which itself grows in cosmology almost exponentially. And the ratio of the two will be just fine, as we will see. All right, so we calculated the energy here, the energy expectation value in this candidate vacuum state is given by that expression. But we haven't really made up our mind yet which mode function to use. Which mode function should we choose such that this energy is minimized? Or in other words, at time eta 1, what should we choose the derivative to be? And what should we choose the amplitude to be such that this energy comes out as small as possible? You may think, well, easy, right? We just choose them 0. If the derivative is 0, if the amplitude is 0, the energy will be 0. Problem solved. It's not that easy, because remember that while it is true that choosing an amplitude and choosing a derivative will fix the mode function, and because it will fix a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, the issue is that not every solution of the Klein-Gordon equation is legal. It also has to obey this Runskin condition that normalizes it. So V and V prime equal to 0 are not going to be possible solutions here. So remember, we called the amplitude at the time where we wanted to fix the mode function the coefficient R, and the derivative at that time we called the coefficient S. We need to determine those two complex coefficients that will single out a solution in the solution space, and therefore a vacuum, and so on. That's all what I said already. So from the above, at the time eta 1, the energy expectation value was that expression. We can express that, it's just easier visually, in terms of the R and the S coefficients. So the energy at time eta 1 is given by this, where R and S just replace the derivative and the amplitude squared. So the question then is, what should we choose for R and S so that the energy is minimized? subject to the constraint that, as we said, the mode functions not only have to obey the Klangon equation, but also the Wronskian condition. And the Wronskian condition is this, if you remember. Mode functions had to be, on top of being solutions to the Klangon equation, also obeying that, so that the A-Dagger commutation relations implied the proper phi-pi commutation relations. Now, V prime is S and V is R, so at time eta 1. Therefore, the Wronskian condition for our coefficients R and S at time eta 1 is simply this one. Therefore, we have a variational principle. We want to minimize the energy. That is to say, we want to minimize this expression here. We want to find complex coefficients S and R that will minimize that expression, subject to the constraint that the coefficients S and R have to obey this Wronskian condition. So it's a matter of constraint optimization. And the key word here is, of course, Lagrange multiplier. So we use a Lagrange multiplier to extremize it. So this is the energy that we want to extremize. I probably should have called it H rather than S. But you know a Lagrangian extremization problems from actions, for example. Maybe that's why I chose the S here. So that's the thing that we want to minimize. We want to minimize the energy. That was the expression for the energy above. We want to minimize that, subject to the constraint that this has to be 2i. So we put here Lagrange multiplier times that. So we have to solve the equations of motion that ds by ds star is equal to 0, ds by dr star equal to 0, and we have to solve the constraint equation, which is over here. I leave it to you as an exercise to show that the solution is this. The solution is that in order to minimize the energy, the coefficients R and S have to be chosen this way, where theta is a phase, theta is arbitrary, could be any number between 0 and 2 pi. It just amounts to an overall phase for the mode function, but an overall phase doesn't make a difference. As you can see, it drops out in the answer. So now we are done. What we found is that we can identify on Friedmann, Roberts, and Walker spacetimes the state of lowest energy at any time we choose. All we have to do is we pick a time when we want to identify what the state is of lowest energy. We pick a time, and then we look at what the value is of omega. Remember, omega being this complicated expression, k squared minus, well, let me just show you again where it was. Where was it? Here it is. Omega is this. In Minkowski space, it would be just k squared plus m squared. It's just the energy squared, really. But on expanding space times, is this expression. So if we want to find out at an arbitrary time on the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker space time, which is the state of lowest energy, then we do it this way. We want to identify that state in the Hilbert space. What we do is we pick a time. At that time, we evaluate omega k. Easy. Just plug it into the expression, right? So we obtain omega k. This is the frequency of the mode oscillator at time omega k. And then we calculate 1 over square root of omega. And we say that the amplitude of the mode function has to have that value. So we pick that mode function, which has this amplitude and that derivative. I think this is the way it went, that this was the amplitude and that was the derivative. So we choose these two numbers as the amplitude and the derivative of the mode function, of a mode function at the time that we've chosen. That determines the mode function, of course, for all times, right? Because once we have its amplitude and its derivative at one time, by the equation of motion, this determines it everywhere. And then That mode function comes along with A and A dagger operators. And the A operator will annihilate a particular vector in the Hilbert space, the vector 0. That vector we just calculated is the vector of lowest energy at the time that we picked. So in particular, if we subscribe to the idea that the vacuum state is the state of lowest energy, this is it. So then we identified which vector in the Hilbert space is the vacuum state at a particular time. We plug in, we find out what these numbers are at that time. That determines amplitude and derivative of a mode function, determines the mode function everywhere. That determines the ANA dagger operators. I mean, they come along with ANA dagger operators, and the state annihilated by the A is then the vacuum state. That's an assumption. We know it's the lowest energy state. That it is the no particle state is an assumption. Let me just put in a box the key condition here, because it's very similar to what will actually determine the vacuum later on. So if we subscribe to this vacuum identification criterion, then the answer to our problem is to identify the vacuum at a particular time, calculate those values, and amplitude and derivative is set equal to that. That determines the mode function. And there we go. We have the quantum field expressed in terms of that mode function, and the state annihilated by A is the vacuum. Okay. Special case Minkowski space. Let's see if our criterion works. At least in Minkowski space, it better be true that the lowest energy state is the vacuum state. Now, in Minkowski space, A, the scale factor is 1 at all time. Omega squared is k squared plus m squared, is a constant. Also, the conformal time is really ordinary time. And so we now conclude from what we discussed earlier that the vector 0 is the state of the lowest energy at any time eta 1. If we chose that mode function, which at given time has this amplitude and this derivative, which mode function is that? Well, it's easy to solve the Klein-Gordon equation in Minkowski space. Given this as initial condition, that's the derivative, then this is what the mode function does at all times. Right? You can easily check at time t equal to t1, this thing is just the identity, and we have the proper initial condition. And when you calculate the derivative, you see that you get down a factor of omega and a factor of I that just makes the square root of omega times I. So amplitude and derivative are correctly fixed. That's it. And if you remember, this was the mode function that we used for Minkowski space earlier on. So we identified the right thing. But I leave it to you as an exercise to check that really all the coefficients match and so on. Right, so in Minkowski space, the state of lowest energy is the vacuum state, and that's that. Now let's go back to our ansatz. At an arbitrary time eta 1, the no particle or vacuum state, we for the moment believe is the state of lowest energy. Now that implies a prediction. See, the universe is expanding. Therefore, the operators are evolving in time in the Heisenberg picture. There's action, there's something happening in the universe. And in particular, the Hamiltonian is changing in time. The Hamiltonian at one time is not the same as the Hamiltonian at a later time. Therefore, what is the state of lowest energy at one time need not be the state of lowest energy at a later time, working in the Heisenberg picture. In the Heisenberg picture, the state of the system, though, stays always the same. So if it was the state of lowest energy at an earlier time, then it will stay described by that vector. But at a later time, that vector is no longer having the interpretation of the lowest energy state. So it will be an excited state with particles in it. We expect particle production. How much? Now, the early universe is a different story. complicated and there are uncertainties. But we do know how fast the universe is expanding right now. And we can calculate how much particle production we have to predict on the basis of our assumption that the vacuum state is the lowest energy state. Straightforward to calculate, but I won't bother you with the details because the result will be negative. Not that the number is negative, but the prediction is wrong. So what we obtain is that the current production rate for particles, let's say of a scalar field, would be on the order of about 10 particles per cubic kilometers per year and per species. Doesn't sound like too much, like 10 particles per cubic kilometer. The thing though is that the estimate is that our universe has only about 10 to the 9 particles on average per cubic kilometers in total. So if you exploded the Earth and the stars and everything and spread it all out evenly, that's about as many as you would get, about 10 to the 9. But that would mean that in 100 million years, the universe would already double its amount of matter in it. And that didn't happen. Basically, we are predicting too much particle production this way, way too much. It's not by many orders of magnitude, but we're predicting too much. Actually, recently there was an item in the news which said that Einstein was probably the first person to suggest. They recently found papers of Einstein that he never submitted for publication because he didn't think they were quite worked out yet. In any case, in the 1920s already or so, he pursued the idea of a steady state universe. He didn't like the idea of a Big Bang. He thought that the universe probably just keeps expanding forever. And then he had to explain why there was matter visible. Because if it has always been expanding, then it would have always been diluting so that we should not see anything around us. Everything would have diluted away given an infinite amount of time. So Einstein needed a mechanism that would repopulate the universe. As it expands, it would dilute. For some reason, by some mechanism, new matter would have to pop up to form new clouds of gas, which could then condense into new stars and so on, which would then be diluted and so on. He didn't have a mechanism for it. But here is a principal mechanism. It's just too efficient. It creates too many particles. So the conclusion we draw from that nowadays is that the vacuum state should not be identified with the state of lowest energy because it predicts more particle production than is needed for a steady state model. In any case, it's ruled out steady state by observations. It's just way too many particles. You know, when we look back far enough in time in the universe with telescopes, we actually see the evolution of stars. The population of stars that are very old has a different distribution from the distribution of the kinds of stars that we see today. So the universe really is evolving. We can see that. So it's no longer an option to pursue a steady state universe. Okay, so we have to reconsider. Remember that any quantum system does not get excited, or actually only very little excited, if we change its parameters very, very slowly. So for example, if we take a harmonic oscillator and we change its frequency very slowly, then we're not going to excite it. Remember the experiment with the string and something oscillating there? When you change the length of the string, you're changing the oscillation frequency. If you do it fast enough, at about the order of the natural frequency of the oscillator, then you can actually excite it. But if you do that very slowly, you're not going to excite the harmonic oscillator. Now, the universe is expanding, all right, but not very dramatically. It's not fast, not now anyway. So we would expect that the mode oscillators of the fields do not get excited by just this little bit of expansion that we experience now. Therefore, really, particle production should be very, very, very low. How can we describe that? So that's the experiment with the string there. How can we improve our criterion for identifying which vector in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum at a particular point in time? Well, consider models where the universe is initially like Minkowski space. So there's no expansion. Let's just imagine a situation where the universe starts out without expansion, and then something happens and it starts expanding, and then maybe later on it becomes Minkowski space again. So initially it starts out with Minkowski space, and then it undergoes expansion. So we have a time-dependent frequency and so on. See, the advantage of that scenario is, I mean, it's not very realistic, obviously, but for our purposes, it would be very convenient because we do know what the right vacuum is at early times for if it's Minkowski space. We know what the Minkowski space vacuum is. We know that for sure because particle physics is so successful with the vacuum that we always use. But notice that if we know what the mode functions, what the mode function is at early time, then we can calculate what the mode function is at later times too, because that's what the Klein-Gordon equation will give us. Right? We need to know the mode function just at a point. We just need to know its amplitude and its derivative at one point, and we have the mode function everywhere. So having such an initial period of Minkowski space is great. So let's assume we have Minkowski space initially, then the universe undergoes an expansion. And let's say that the expansion is not dramatic. It's adiabatic. It's not abrupt. Okay? Then we expect, in this case, essentially no particle creation. Even though the Hamiltonian may be time-dependent, the low-energy state may be somewhat time-dependent, but since it's slow, there should be no particle creation. Remember that our criterion that we tried earlier, vacuum state is the lowest energy state, had no concern for how fast things are moving. Right? We just identified blindly lowest energy state is vacuum state, no matter whether the evolution was abrupt or slowly. We just stuck to this criterion all the time. Now we are saying that, wait a moment, even if things are changing quite a bit, if it's very slow, we shouldn't have particle creation, because the harmonic oscillator should not get excited. OK, so what we are saying here is that the vacuum state should, the no particle state should, in this circumstance where the universe is expanding adiabatically, should always essentially stay the same vector in the Hilbert space. Mm-hmm.
So this only works if you put our system in a box, because otherwise there's always, or I guess my question is, isn't there always a mode where to which the change of the universe is fast?
Yes, we will get to that. There are different regimes. What is fast and what is slow is relative to the natural frequency of the oscillator. And in principle, yes, if you look at very long wavelength modes, their frequency, if it's massless theory, is going to be very, very slow. So whatever, however slow the universe is, it might still be non-adiabatic with respect to that mode. That's right. So whatever I'm saying is for a fixed mode. So you hold the mode fixed, and then what I'm saying is that if the universe expands slowly enough compared to the natural oscillation frequency of that mode, and that's virtually always the case, because the mode oscillates very quickly, the universe doesn't move very quickly, then we say it's adiabatic. It's only a matter for very, very long wavelength modes. And if you put it in a box, you don't have that concern. You're right. OK, so how can we identify that state? That state in the Hilbert space, which basically is such that we always pick out the same state, no matter at what time we pick the vacuum state, we pick always the same one. What criterion gives us always the same candidate for the vacuum state? Or in other words, we need a vacuum identification criterion, which when we apply it at one time, the answer will be, you have to use this mode function. If we apply it at another time, the criterion will tell us, you have to use this mode function. And the associated zero vector is the vacuum. Another time, you know, you have to use this mode function, and so on. And if the whole thing was adiabatic, these three mode functions are the same one, right? So that we have the same vacuum state identified. No particles were created. So we are looking for a criterion for identifying the vacuum state at a particular time, a criterion that's robust, that stays the same, that picks out the same vector, the same Hilbert space vector, and therefore the same mode function, no matter when we query it, at what time we query it, always picks out the same one if the universe evolves adiabatically. So now we know what the mode function was at the very early times when the universe was Minkowski space. This was the mode function, right? We know that. We calculated it earlier today, but also this is the solution we had earlier in the course for Minkowski space. Now, this equation tells us what the mode function was doing at very early times when the universe was still Minkowski space. But this tells us also what the mode function is doing at any later time, because we just plug this into the Klein-Gordon equation, where it will tell us also how this will evolve. It will become more complicated, of course, as the universe expands. This is only the way the solution looks like at early time. But we can calculate, just by extending it, what it does at later time. And the proposition is that when we do this, this is the answer. Assume that the universe is expanding only adiabatically, slowly, nothing abrupt. Our harmonic oscillators of the modes are not going to get kicked. Then if this is how the universe starts out evolving, because it's Minkowski space, then this is the mode function at all times. If you look at early times, this formula reduces to that one. At late times, this is still valid, even though now this has to obey a much more non-trivial Klein-Gordon equation. And the Klein-Gordon equation is the Minkowski space Klein-Gordon equation early on, but later on it becomes non-trivial because the omega becomes time-dependent. So you see, this is almost the same as this formula, only that we have made omega time-dependent. Right? Here is an omega which is not time-dependent. That's the Minkowski space solution. Down here, we have a time-dependent omega. Okay, but also, we have made this thing here time-dependent. And instead of just having the time difference between start time and some later time, now we are integrating here. Obviously, if omega is not changing in time, then you can just integrate this thing out and you get the time difference between eta naught and eta, eta naught and eta, right? It turns out that this is not the completely exact solution. It's the so-called adiabatic approximation to the exact solution. This is exceedingly precise if nothing quick happens. And I leave it to you as an exercise. to check that this is so. And what do we mean by this being a good approximation to the exact solution? Well, we say that a mode k evolves adiabatically slowly if, and this refers back to your question earlier, we say that a mode changes slowly, the universe changes slowly for a given mode, if the change, the rate of change of the oscillator's frequency compared to the oscillator's frequency itself is small. And also the acceleration of the change of the frequency is to be small when compared to the frequency of the harmonic oscillator itself. So when the change and when the rate of change and the acceleration of change is small, then that's when we say that the universe expands, evolves slowly, compared to the natural frequency of the mode k under consideration. Under these approximations, that is a very good approximation to the exact solution, no matter what really the evolution of the universe is. No matter what omega k of eta really is, as long as it's slow compared to the, relative to these criteria there, this is a very good solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. And it's an exercise for you to just plug that in there. Basically, plug this proposed solution, the adiabatic solution, into the time-dependent Klein-Gordon equation, and check that it solves the time-dependent Klein-Gordon equation if these conditions hold, and you can drop the corresponding terms. Okay. Now, is the initial Minkowski space period really necessary? Remember, what we try to do here is develop a criterion for identifying which vector in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum state at a particular time. And what we did here was to do, I mean, we did just that. We said that if the universe starts out in Minkowski space, the situation is easy. In Minkowski space, this is the mode function that describes the vacuum, and this is the mode function at all times. This is just valued at very early times. This is at all times. And so we have here the mode function that describes the state, which at early times is the Minkowski state. But we want to identify which is the vacuum state, not just very early when the universe may be in the Minkowski vacuum, but even at any time. Even any time later, when the universe is in the middle of doing something, expanding, shrinking, or whatnot. Even then, we would like to be able to identify which vector in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum state. And remember, the strategy was this, or what we had in mind was this. We need a criterion for picking out that vector, which works like this. If the universe is adiabatically evolving all the time, and we apply that criterion at one point in time, the criterion will say, you have to use this mode function. If you use this mode function, the associated vector 0 will be the vacuum state. The criterion should tell us, at a later time, you have to use that mode function, and the associated vector 0 will be describing the vacuum state at that time, and so on. And if the universe expanded adiabatically, the criterion should actually give us the same mode function every time. The criterion should pick out the same mode function every time. Because we are not expecting any particle creation if the universe expands adiabatically. So we should always have the same mode function, therefore always the same state as the vacuum state, therefore no particle creation. So we can reformulate the question. This is This is the adiabatic solution. Is there a criterion that would always pick out this one? Right, that's where we are going. So what we notice here, this is just what I just said. Indeed, we notice the following. When we looked at the case above, the mode function, the adiabatic solution there, this adiabatic solution always obeys the condition. At every point in time, it obeys the condition that its amplitude is given by 1 over square root of omega. By the way, that's the same condition that the minimum energy condition had. But its derivative, the derivative of the adiabatic mode function, is given by this. Much more complicated. If that term were absent, then the equation would be v prime is I times square root of omega k, which is what we had earlier as the condition for picking out the lowest energy state. So what we see here is that the adiabatic mode function, the adiabatic solution, obeys almost the minimum energy condition. Because its amplitude is given by that, its derivative is given by this, with a bit of a correction. If that was absent, this condition would describe the lowest energy state, but it's not exactly the lowest energy state. So this motivates the following definition. We identify the vacuum state, the so-called adiabatic vacuum state. Or we call it the adiabatic vacuum state, but we really mean just the vacuum state, the no-particle state. We identify it as a vector in the Hilbert space in the following way. Consider an arbitrary time eta 1. It's the time when we want to identify what state in Hilbert space is the vacuum state at that time. Now, assume that the evolution of the universe, and therefore all of the omega k, is adiabatically slow for a mode k around the time eta 1. We want stuff to be adiabatic when we talk about the vacuum state, because otherwise we are in the middle of particle production. Now, we then identify that vector in the Hilbert space as the vacuum vector, as describing the true no particle state of the field theory, as that state whose mode function V is specified by these properties. Okay? So we say that the mode function whose associated vector 0 describes the vacuum at state eta 1 is the mode function which obeys these adiabaticity conditions at time eta, at that time where we want to know what the vacuum state is. Okay, if we do that, then we have one thing guaranteed, namely, if the universe evolves adiabatically all the time, this criterion will always give us the same mode function, namely this one. This one, right? This mode function obeys these amplitude and derivative conditions at all times. So if the universe is evolving adiabatically, then our new criterion for picking out the vacuum always picks out the vacuum that comes from this mode function. And therefore, if the universe is expanding adiabatically, with our new criterion, we're predicting no particle creation. Because we're always predicting the same state is the vacuum state. And the same vector in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum state at all time. Because it's always the vector that comes with the same mode function. And therefore, if the universe is prepared in that vacuum state, then in the Heisenberg picture, it's always going to be in that state. And that state also continues to be the vacuum state. So we don't get particle creation. So, for example, today that the universe is adiabatically expanding, we are not predicting particle creation. But this criterion is local in time. It gives us more flexibility. We can even treat situations now where the universe is not always adiabatically expanding. This is a criterion that we can apply at any time, independently of what the past was or what the future will be. The universe might have had a wild past. All sorts of exotic things went through bursts of acceleration and shrinkage or whatnot. If at the later time, when it's calmed down a little bit, we want to know, well, by the way, what is the vacuum state at the moment? Which vector in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum at the moment? Well, all we have to do is calculate the omega, calculate omega prime, and then plug it into those formulas that will give us an amplitude and a derivative for a mode function. And having the amplitude and derivative of a mode function at one time gives us the mode function at all times. So now we can write down our quantum field in terms of the mode functions and associate A and A dagger operators. And the A operator annihilates a particular vector in the Hilbert space. That's the vacuum, the no particle state, at the time that we picked. And if the universe undergoes some wild non-trivial evolution, then at this time, this criterion picks out a particular vector in the Hilbert space, and another time it picks out another vector. Only if the evolution was adiabatic all the time, this will pick out always the same mode function, therefore always the same vacuum state, therefore predicts no particle production. Okay, so overall, that's what I just said. The definition is considered arbitrary time. If you want to know what the vacuum state is, plug in the omega and omega prime at that particular time into this formula, get the amplitude and derivative of the mode function at this time, get the mode function at all times. You can express the field at all times in terms of these mode functions. The associated A and A dagger operators are such that the A operator annihilates the state in the Hilbert space, which is the adiabatic vacuum at the time eta 1 that we considered. So that criterion is similar. Remember, this was the criterion here. Let's look at both of them simultaneously. This is the vacuum identification criterion at time eta 1 going by the adiabatic definition, and this was the lowest energy definition. If the universe, or whenever the universe is not expanding, then that term drops out because omega prime is zero. The frequency of the harmonic oscillators doesn't change. And all of this is just the same as that. And the universe is again in its vacuum state if there are no particles present, if it's at the lowest energy state. Curiously, consider what that means. It means that while the universe is expanding, the lowest energy state is not the vacuum state, which means that the state of lowest energy is a state in which particles are flying around. Not many, but in principle, yes. It's sort of a condensate of particles still around. And ultimately, the origin of this is that when you look at the vacuum identification criterion that we had considered earlier, where we just said lowest energy is the state of no particles, we made a simple, naive mistake. Basically, lowest energy condition, the criterion that said that the vacuum state is the state of lowest energy, said take the frequency of the harmonic oscillator at the time in question, plug it in here, and you get the vacuum. But what is the frequency of a harmonic oscillator? If the harmonic oscillator is not parametrically changing, it's easy. It just has one number, omega, at this frequency. But when the frequency omega is changing, then it's naive to think that the value omega at a particular time is the actual oscillation frequency. Right? It's not. Let's put it this way. If you have tuning forks. Okay? If you have tuning forks of different frequencies, and now you tune your violin and you go through a range of frequencies, you might think that as you go through a particular frequency, the particular tuning forks will resonate, right? They will. But the thing is that if you Fourier transform a varying frequency, you will find that it's not simply that you have one sharp frequency at one point in time and that is moving over time. That's not how it works. It's smeared out and its center is not where you think it would be. It's just that a time-dependent frequency is a non-trivial concept. And what works better for cosmology, what experiments tell us, is that this is a much better way of identifying what the frequency at a point in time really is. The effective frequency for the purpose of identifying the vacuum, at least. There's also a way to look at this in the Schrödinger picture. In the Schrödinger picture, it's the state that evolves in time. So at every time now, a different vector can be the vacuum vector. Now, if the evolution is adiabatic, we have that if the system starts out in the vacuum state, then it stays in the vacuum state. But it's just that the vacuum state is no longer the ground state exactly. It's no longer the lowest energy state. Right, so when we are now ready to do the study of the early universe, and we will use that very same criterion. We will use the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion to identify what state the universe was in, or still is in, because we used the Heisenberg picture, only that we won't apply it to the slow expansion now, but to the rather dramatic event at the very beginning. OK? Okay, that's it for today.